so many ways to say I love you in different languages across the land. You haven't heard them all, so I'll tell you as only a true geek can.
Hello, and welcome to the plague edition of Geekily Yoked. I am Lehman Kessler.
And I'm Rachel Kessler.
That's Mother Rachel Kessler.
I am a priest and here in the Anglican Diocese of Toronto and a PhD in medieval literature. So I'm a giant nerd.
And I am filled with diseases. And I'm also a huge dork. We are, as always, the best married Christian geek podcast.
If a little low on energy this edition.
We're going to be awesome.
Rachel,
how has your geek fortnight been?
Oh, it's been it really is a fortnight, isn't it?
It is.
Well, I finally finished Veronica Mars, which is good, because I can finally return the DVDs.
All of it?
Well, just the first two seasons.
Oh, okay.
So I should say I finished the DVDs of Veronica Mars that had been loaned to me by our friend who lives in Boston, and she is now in town this weekend, so I can actually return her DVDs to her.
I see. And what were your final thoughts on...
Second season more than the first season.
Yeah, what seemed to go up for you?
Oh, I just think the mystery was pretty, like the school, like multiple different mysteries. I think
were you able to distinguish the various Caucasian males a little better?
Eventually, no. I just still can't get over the fact that there are people in the opening credits, and I'm just like, what is this person's name again? They're in like every three episodes. I don't know.
You also finished the fifth season of Deep Space Nine.
I did. I like Deep Space Nine so much.
So much. I do. And now we're working our way into the sixth season.
I've really come around to Kira, to Major Kira.
Yeah.
I didn't like her at first, and I find her a really cool character. This whole, like, the journey she's gone through from being this revolutionary... to having a complicated relationship with the Cardassians, to, like, in the beginning of the sixth season, finding herself, like...
Coming
to the realization that she's become a collaborator, and how does she reconcile that with her past, and that inspiring her towards action, and I don't know. And then, like, the whole religious dimension of her character and how that plays into her relationship with Sisko, and I don't know, I just really like her as a character.
They also seem to be toning down the shoulder pads a touch.
She is distinctly less 90s than she was at the beginning, it's true.
Yeah, you can definitely see the fashion, like, tighten up and get a little less crazy.
And while I really love Goldacott as a villain, I am not with our friend Randy, who is, like, the creepiest Dukat Kira shipper in the world.
Well, you know, sometimes...
Isn't it, like, specifically, though, the version of her from the Mirrorverse?
That's possible. But the less we speak about the Dominatrix or whatever she's called in the Alterverse, Mirrorverse. So we are working our way through Deep Space Nine, and we've also been watching the little snippets here and there of Next Generation.
Oh, yeah, you've been giving me the Next Gen highlights reel.
That's right, sort of, you know, popping around from season to season, trying to find the good Data episodes.
Because I have, for some reason, gotten myself roped into going to Toronto Comic Con tomorrow.
That's right, so how do you feel about that? Well, it's going to be exciting.
I feel like I've stolen a seat from someone who would really appreciate seeing a panel of the entire Next Gen cast.
Do you feel like a cardboard cutout of Aragorn taking up an extra seat space?
And I sort of feel like I wish this, if it were the whole cast of Deep Space Nine, man, I would so be there.
Yeah, that would be nice. Even just Andrew J. Robinson would be
cool. And I think the problem is because whoever's organizing Toronto Comic Con clearly spent all their money getting the cast of Next Generation all together. Like, so it's not just that there's this big event tomorrow evening, which is the panel with the whole cast. They didn't have any money to bring anyone else to Toronto. So there's nothing going on at Toronto Comic Con. Sean Astin is there.
Oh, there we go.
But I think I'm not going to make his panel because we're going a little bit later.
Oh, fair enough.
But
and will he be talking about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles anyway? Since
that's his
new project. Yeah.
Okay, that's fine.
I think he's possibly the new Raphael.
Really?
Yeah.
Weird. Anyway, it just kind of means that there's nothing going on at Comic-Con other than next-gen people.
Fair enough.
And it's like, so they're having the big panel with everyone, later in the evening. And then throughout the day, it's like, you can go to the Worf and Data panel. You can go to the Beverly Crusher and Geordi panel. Although why they didn't do Geordi and Data in a panel just makes me sad.
I was about to say, Geordi and Data in the morning.
I know. Like, if I actually were the type of person to get up and ask a question in a panel, I would either ask them how they feel about LARP Trek.
Yes.
For those of you who don't know, the webcomic, which is based on the premise that Deep Space Nine is just a LARP run by the cast of Next Generation. Or the premise that Geordi and Data were the original Troy and Abed.
Fair enough. Those are all very useful questions.
But it should not surprise you at all that the panel, our friend was like, we have to get there in time to go to this panel, was the Gates McFadden and LeVar Burton panel.
Yeah.
You're the only person in the world that wants to see Beverly Crusher that badly.
Maybe she'll talk about her time choreographing Muppets in Labyrinth.
Awesome. I could ask her about that.
There we go.
Anyway. So that's my life.
We'll do a post-con report our next episode.
So are you surviving aside from having the world's most raging sinus infection?
Oh, I'll be fine. I just sound like death. I got to have my very first sort of interview, I guess, to potentially do voiceover for a video game, which would be kind of cool. Of course, it didn't help that this whole sinusy throat awfulness was started up when I went to go speak with the guys. So he was like, all right, let's practice doing some lines. I'm like, the enemy is coming from the right. Use your lasers. He's like, maybe we should do this later.
Fortunately, he does know you outside of...
That's right. Rocking some nepotism. So that was an exciting thing. But what I thought we could discuss this week is something very near and dear to my heart, at least. That has led to a couple of fights, which people always enjoy.
We don't fight!
And that would be board games! Yay, board games! Yay! We all love board games. Now, we both come from weirdly gamey households.
Yeah, but my family's, like, sad. Like, there was actually a great Cracked article that was going around Facebook the other day that was, like, the top five reasons why people hate board games.
Yeah. Monopoly.
Monopoly, Risk. Monopoly made it on there. Risk. Connect Four.
Yeah.
Just for being pointless.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is so true. This is why I hate board games, because I grew up in a family that played stupid board games.
But you guys did more than just board games. I mean, you guys are just a gaming family. You guys do a lot of card games and like...
Yeah, but card games are stupid too.
Anyway.
I played a lot of Contract Rummy in my childhood.
Yeah, and I played that weird, like, it's not quite poker, it's not quite, like,
Gin Rummy. Well, and what annoyed you about that was that you had to play until there was only one person left standing.
Yeah.
So it was like you got eliminated, you had nothing to do.
Yeah, so then I just went to watch Portlandia episodes, which was not that awful.
I think you won in that scenario.
I
played that I was asleep on the couch card.
Well, this is a big issue. I mean, we can talk about, like, you know, the Euro games and the kind of the modern renaissance in gaming. Although it's been going on for, like, 20 years now, so I don't know.
But you grew up with older brothers who introduced you to really cool games.
No, I've been playing a lot of games for years, simply because my brothers were older and really into it. But what I wanted to say real quick was, one of the things that I enjoy about modern games, as opposed to your Monopolies or your Risks, is they tend to have a everyone-plays-until-the-end style mechanic, as opposed to a kind of siege mentality of people sort of dropping out. You know, like, whoever goes bankrupt first in Monopoly, well, I hope you brought a book.
Yeah. Same for Risk.
Yeah, same thing with Risk and other games like that. You sort of have to just sit around and, like, you know, in theory, you're cheering on your other friends or, I don't know, checking out.
But let's be honest, does anyone actually play a game of Monopoly or Risk to the very end?
Who knows? I definitely had the worst game of Risk, where we got the rules wrong and we're, like, increasing our soldiers, like, exponentially every round. So, like, by the end, we didn't, like, have enough pieces, so our army sizes were listed on pieces of paper. It was brutal. But no, you brought up the fact that I grew up not only in a sort of a gaming household, but in a sort of gaming household that was always looking for new games. You know, when we look at the game closet at your parents' house, it's a lot of, like, stuff from the 60s and 70s. Whereas my brothers were sort of always on the lookout for new games, we're always hunting for kind of fun, new, weird stuff. When we would get together for family vacations, you know, the first thing we would do is go and get a game so we could try it out. And, you know, usually one person would be designated the sort of the TGS spotter, the this game sucks.
So
there had to be one person who could...
too much 30 Rock. I was like, the girly show?
No, the idea was you sort of have someone who has permission to say, you know what, guys, this game sucks. Can we stop now? Because there's a lot of games where you sort of, you know, you don't want to stop because you think the other person's having fun. And so you sort of need... It's the equivalent of a gaming safety word, I guess. But we had tons and tons of games. And we had my brothers really loved the super complicated Avalon Hill games. Avalon Hill was this amazing company that made games with rule books that looked like, you know, computer manual instructions. They were just these big, thick, heavy things that would have, like, subsections and, like, mini headers. So it would be like, you know, refer to rule 1-A, you know, lowercase, you know, Roman numeral 4. And you'd flip, 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 flip. And they had tons of, like, pieces that would always get lost. And, you know, you would spend 2 hours trying to figure out how to play the game and then, like, an hour playing the game before someone would say, this game sucks. And that was called bonding in my household. So I definitely grew up in that environment. But I was being the younger kid, you know, by about 10 years. I definitely had what I discovered very quickly, a bad attitude towards gaming. I was a bad loser. And, you know,
to be fair, at least one of your brothers can be a fairly obnoxious winner.
Well, that part of it. But my defense was to essentially try to, you know, play, but kind of disconnect from it. Like, you know, not play to win, play to just do weird stuff or to, you know, quote unquote, have fun, which, you know, as you grow up, you sort of realize, oh, I'm just being a jerk. But it became amusing because essentially it added a new element of strategy to the game where my brothers essentially tried to, like, aim me at the other brother. Like, try to figure out how to appeal to my sense of, like, whimsy or like, you know, anarchic, you know, play style. Like, oh, look, you know, Jamie has, like, you know, that place over there that has a fun name. Why don't you go try and conquer it? Ah, that sounds like fun. I will go and attack. So, you know, it was a lot of that style of manipulation. Eventually, however, I think I began to grow up and become a bit more mature and accept that losing is part of it and not get so worked up. But there were times, though, I remember times when I got super invested in games as a kid that I just really just so worked up to the point that I just, you know, probably should not have been playing. So it's nice to feel like one has at least, you know, matured in certain areas. Now, we mentioned the kind of the Eurogame renaissance, and for those who aren't familiar, you know, for a long time, board games were dominated by your Risks, your Monopolies, your Mousetraps, where, you know, the fun was to set up the trap, play it, like, you know, set it off once or twice, and then put the game away, because the actual game is, like, really dumb and involves collecting, like, cheese wedges or something. I don't know. Not a good game. And then you had the sort of, you know, there had always been this sort of current of really intense games like the Avalon Hill games or like all these really like
Talisman.
Specific...
Shall we talk about Talisman?
Well, we're going to get to Talisman.
I feel like we need to spend like a whole segment on Talisman.
We'll talk about Talisman. But there were also like these very intense war games or like simulation games, you know, like that were meant to represent one battle in the Civil War or, you know, and you know, those games had always been going on, but they were not part of the mainstream. And it really wasn't until games like Settlers of Catan, that suddenly...
We will talk about Settlers.
And then games like Carcassonne and Puerto Rico and Agricola, I mean, these things sort of all began to spring up, these sort of high concept, but like they touched on the imagination in interesting ways. Like they really... I don't know, there's something... ineffably interesting about them compared to your Monopolies.
Well, what makes all of those games work is that there's different dynamics and there's different aspects to all of those games, right? Like there's just so many moving pieces and there's every time you play them, they're slightly different.
Yes.
Which is really cool.
Yes.
So something like Citadels is a game we really like where you're kind of building your little town.
Yeah.
And you get to play different roles throughout the games. You know, sometimes you're the king, sometimes you're the...
assassin.
Yeah. And it's just really neat.
Well, and the luck component is very different. I mean, a big issue with Monopoly is, you know, it's all about kind of where the dice make you wind up. And, you know, yeah, there's sort of a negotiation part of it, but still, you know, where you wind up, you know, you can do weird things. Same with Risk. These games try to move... they still have luck. They still have an element of chance, but they move more away from that.
Well, and I think the games that are really successful, or the ones I really like, are where it's not just about luck. There's a certain degree of gameplay to it, and decisions that you're making are going to impact how well you do. But it's not so strategy-driven that it becomes onerous.
Yeah, it's not diplomacy where you're, yeah, you know, like, which is no luck. It's all based on trying to, you know, manipulate and connive.
So should we go through some games and sort of do like our review of some of our favorite games?
Yeah, I mean, there's tons and tons of games we can go through.
We
can do a highlight. Let's start with Settlers.
Shall we? Because, shall we indeed?
Because I think my brothers probably introduced me to Settlers, and I really enjoyed it from the get go. I really like the feel of it, the texture, the tiles and the little wooden pieces, the flow of the game, the way it sort of moved around. There was sort of a luck aspect, but also a kind of a trading and strategy and building up your tiny little colony.
And I hate Settlers of Catan.
Now, Rachel, how can you hate Settlers of Catan?
I don't know. I just hate it so much.
This seems irrational.
It probably is. I have nothing to really back this up. I think that really there's two things. One is that I don't like the fact that when you start to lose, there comes a point in Catan where if you sort of get blocked off from trade routes and you know you can't build your roads anywhere to build your settlements, there just comes a point where the game is not fun anymore.
You're just waiting it out.
Yeah, and I think it kind of goes back to that. You're not out of the game. You're still playing it through to the end, but there comes a point where you feel like you're effectively... you have your hands tied because there's too little you can do. And the second thing is, I think it's just one of... it's not that Settlers is such a bad... I mean, Settlers is a fine game. Like, it's way better than all those other games that we... talked disparage about, right? Like, it's way better than Monopoly. It's way better than most of the games that exist in my parents' gaming closet. But I just, I think it's like that weird gateway game.
Yeah.
Like, it's between, like people who are just really, if you're at some, like, really casual board gaming event, like in seminary when we would have those games nights, and it's, you know, a lot of people who might not be, like, board gamers as hobbyers, they'd all pull out Settlers.
Yeah.
Because it's like that game that, you know, real board game people, like,
we'll
board
play.
Game aficionados yeah. will play it, and, you know, people who would just as easily play Monopoly would play it.
No, it's at that nice side.
And I feel like it's just one of these things that I kind of have come to resent it for that reason, because maybe because I've been at too many of these events where I feel like, why do we have to play Settlers again? There's so many better things to play. Let's play Dominion. Let's play Citadels. Let's play Talisman. You really can't. We'll get to Talisman.
I can see your point. I think Settlers, this point spread is never so big unless you're getting absolutely trashed.
Yeah, well,
which
my point.
Happen.
Yeah, but my point is not that the point spread is necessarily that large, but there just gets to be when you're playing it, get a point where you just feel like you can't, and it just gets
that you're
kind
being
of frustrating.
Stopped. No, fair enough.
Maybe I've just played it with some really obnoxious people.
That is, now that can ruin a game, I will admit. Like, I didn't play Munchkin for a while because the first few times I'd played Munchkin, which is meant to be a silly, silly game, it's supposed to, like, represent the worst parts of, like, Dungeons and Dragons where everyone is backstabbing each other and trying to steal each other's treasure, and, you know, it's ridiculous. It has a Duck of Doom. A Duck of Doom is a part of this game. But I would play with these people who take it so seriously, and they get really angry. And you know, the worst thing is when you're playing with someone who begins yelling at you that you're not playing something right. And the reason you're not playing something right is you're not following, like, a set strategy, which is making them win.
Right.
Because I found this in certain people, certain friends of mine. You know, I'll play a game with them, and it'll be a game that they've played a lot. And if you know, I or someone else have sort of... not playing, I guess, the most optimally, which is allowing someone else to win, then they get angry because if I had been playing more optimally, then they would be winning because they have taken into account the fact that everyone should be playing optimally. It's very weird. It's like my brother's trying to aim me.
Right.
Like, yeah. they don't figure that out. And so they, instead of sort of being just being like upset that they're not winning, they blame you for not playing at your best because then they would be able to somehow manipulate that into victory. It's very strange. And again, it's ruined a game like Munchkin for me because I'm like, oh, is this just a problem with Munchkin? You just can't play? But no, it's a problem with this type of people. Now, a wonderful game that I've pulled out at many, many parties and that you have taken with you on various outings is Apples to Apples.
Yes. You know what is the best place to play Apples to Apples? When you're locked in a convent with 16 other candidates for ordained ministry and you're all being... Like, you're spending 2.5 days being interviewed by, like, various people. And
the diocese?
Yes. Well, even beyond the diocese.
Oh, right.
And you're playing Apples to Apples. That brings out some really fascinating...
It's for those who...
Subconscious.
For those who don't know, Apples to Apples is possibly one of the most brilliant psychological games of all time. The game is split into two different types of cards, red cards and green cards. The red cards all have nouns on them. The green cards all have adjectives. Every turn, one player takes the role of a judge, pulls out a green card, and will say something like effervescent or smelly or radical. And everyone has to play a red card, not that they think best matches the green card, but that they think the judge would pick to match the green card. And it's completely subjective, you know. People, you know, the judge can use whatever criteria they want.
Which makes it the perfect game to destroy my father.
It's very true. For anyone,
oh, it was awesome.
For anyone who has a very literal mind, it's you know.
We play this with my dad. He's like, no, Rachel, you're absolutely wrong. You need to pick this card because objectively speaking, it is a fact that you know.
This is hotter than this.
Yeah.
There's no way that a volcano is less hot than Brad Pitt. But no, but it's because you have to know the person. So it's a game of psychology. You know, it's like Wesley and Vincini. You know, you have to, you know, divide what you know of...
Me?
You know, yes, from what you know of yourself. And so it's amazing. And you know, like I know for a fact, you know, playing with Rachel, never to play the card that actually... objectively makes sense because they'll just Rachel finds those to be too obvious. So if it's hot and one of my cards is, you know, fire, I know for a fact that that is not going to work.
And if it's Lehman, I know that it should probably be somewhat tasteless.
True enough.
Borderline offensive, possibly even racist.
That does tend to do very well. Although then when people think that that's the only way to win, I start getting contrary and go for the unracist things because I'm trying to avoid them. I'm trying to stymie their pigeonholing.
Although I think I was the one who once gave a victory to the person who played Rosa Parks when the adjective was lazy.
I think you won that victory. I think you played Rosa Parks, Rachel.
Am I that horrible?
You were that person. Well, she didn't get up.
I know.
But my problem with Apples to Apples is I'll be playing it with my friends, and we will all be tasteless and horrible. And then
you start playing it in a random group of strangers?
Precisely. And, you know, the card will be hilarious. I'll be like, yeah. Cancer! And they'll just stare at me and be like, that's not funny. I'm like, oh, right, real people. And there's a game which is very similar to Apples to Apples, but I actually am not a huge fan of. It's Cards Against Humanity. And it's Apples to Apples, only it's just supposed to be offensive. It's just, like, gross out and racist and just bad taste things.
And the offense and the bad taste is sort of funny when it's not supposed to be there, because then you're sort of commenting on the bad taste, but when the bad taste is built into the game,
well, yeah.
Then it just seems tacky.
Well, it just, you know, with Apples to Apples, it's very organic when something happens. In the case of Cards Against Humanity, not only does it feel sort of, like, forced, but it also feels sort of perfunctory. But anyway, I mean, it's mostly the kind of fun to just see the gross out stuff.
But I guess for me, part of why I like Apples to Apples is that I feel like it does what Settlers of Catan does, but in a more enjoyable way for me at least, which is it is a really nice, like it's the ultimate party game.
Yeah.
You can pull it out with pretty much any crowd of people that does not include my father. And everyone will enjoy it to at least some degree, and it allows for conversation. It's not, there's no real competitive aspect to it because it's so random that winning doesn't really mean anything.
And it's,
and you can play it from like 4 people to 20 people, really.
And you can sort of keep playing until you're done. Like, there's no.
And people can drop in and drop out because it really doesn't matter.
And what's fun is that at the end, whichever card you've won, these adjectives in front of you will often say, you know, oh, that's who you are. So, oh, you're stinky and effervescent. And my brother, when he was working with a youth group, found that they were developing a sort of a weird metagame whereby they did not want to win negative-sounding adjectives and so would try to essentially, like, throw those rounds. So you would get these weird kind of, like, rounds where everyone was throwing their worst cards at an adjective, and so the judge was having to figure out, like, which of them was, like, the least worst. Which I think could be a lot of fun to play.
So my other anti-Catan game, or I think the answer to Catan, is the game we recently discovered, really just about a year ago, if even that. Not Talisman. We'll get to Talisman. Seven Wonders.
Seven Wonders, yes.
It's a great game.
We were over at a friend's place. A couple of our friends had us over for a barbecue, and they pulled out Seven Wonders. And I had, you know, I'm just... being in game stores, I'd seen it, but had never really thought much about it. And it is absolutely wonderful. I've played it with my youth group at church. I have
teaching them about the empires discussed in the Bible.
Precisely,
wasn't that your
yes?
Like,
they need to learn about how difficult Israel had it. You know, when the Egyptians were able to build their, you know, their pyramids, and yeah, hey, in the leadership expansion, you can play Solomon. So,
oh wow. But no, it's a great game. It's because it has so many moving parts, and that's one of the things that we really love about it, is that it is so hard to predict who's winning. And like, we were playing it about a week or so ago with a friend of ours who was like, it was his first time playing it, and he was getting really upset because he thought he was doing really, really terrible. And in the end, I mean, I think he came in like 3rd out of 5 or something. I mean, it's really does a good job of disguise, because there's a lot of hidden points built in at the end of the game. And so it's, again, one of these games where you can just enjoy the process instead of being concerned about winning necessarily.
And there's moving pieces, but luckily it's not so busy that it bogs stuff down. Like, the game goes by surprisingly fast.
Well, it's another one of these games with a built-in playtime, right? Yeah. Like, you go through these steps, and then you get to the end of the game. And it's like a lot of these German games, I find, that they are very non-intuitive when you're trying to explain them. I mean, when we had these people over playing Seven Wonders, I mean, you probably spent twice as long
explaining
it as you did when we did our first playthrough.
Yeah.
So they seem, like, crazy complicated when you're trying to explain them to anyone. And then you start playing them, and it makes a lot of sense, and it works really, really simply.
And it's a wonderful to see play. Another game very much like that is Dominion. Mm-hmm. Dominion is a game that's very hard to explain, but as soon as you play, you go, oh, I see what's going on here. Because it's a deck-building game. I don't even know how to begin. You're trying to sort of build up a civilization, but a civilization exists only in your hand and in your deck. So every round, it's about like, okay, I'm going to purchase, you know, a blacksmith, and I'm going to use the foundry in order to draw 3 extra cards and to do this and this. And you're chaining together these string of actions in order to kind of get victory points and to get more gold. And it's really a lot of fun and incredibly variable because the game comes with about like 30 cards, but you only ever use 10 in any given game.
So you could always rejig what cards you're
using.
Although you found that sometimes if you get the combination wrong, the game will either last 15 minutes or 3 hours.
Well, no, this is the first time we played. We played the sort of with the basic set, and the game took about an hour. Then we played where I think we played random. Like, we just, like, chose a random 10 to play with, and that took about 20 minutes. And then we played the version that only used, like, aggressive cards, because you can actually play the game so that no one ever interacts with anyone, which is strange. You're sort of just taking your turns and, you know, kind of not... It's just a question of who has the most points at the end of the game. But there are aggressive cards that, like, steal cards or take people's money or do things like that. And we played with only those cards, and it took 2 hours, and it was brutal, and it was just a slog. Because it does sort of have a built-in time limit, but it's based on kind of certain criteria being met. So it's really, it's a fascinating game, and I haven't played it in far too long. But it's a lot of fun. And again, one of these things that you're sort of, you know, struggling to try to explain to people, but as soon as you actually sort of play and you begin to sort of get the rhythm of it down, suddenly makes a lot of sense.
We like the German games.
And I think in those cases, they're possibly Belgian. I know Seven Wonders. Wonders, I think, is Belgian. But yeah, these
well,
places...
Well, the weird thing about Seven... Sorry, just to go back to that, is that, it has this aspect, much like Settlers, where you're collecting resources, you're trying to get resources, you can trade... You know, if you need a resource, you can spend somewhat, you know, you spend your gold to get resources from your neighbors. You can get cards that allow you to get resources for cheaper.
Yeah.
But you're only ever interacting with the people on either side of you.
Yeah.
So if you have five or six people playing, you only interact with two of them.
Yeah. It has a very interesting mechanic whereby when it comes to trading and when it comes to military, the only players that immediately matter to you are whoever's literally sitting on your left and your right. So if there's four of you, there will be someone on the other side of the table that you really don't interact with, except, and this is a very, very brilliant yet strange part of Seven Wonders, is you're playing out of a deck of cards, and when you play one card, you then pass it to your neighbor. You pass the hand to your neighbor. So everyone is sharing, essentially, these cards. And so not only do you have to decide, okay, what do I want to play on this turn, but what do I want to deny to my neighbor? So there's many paths to victory in Seven Wonders. So if you're trying to be militaristic, but your neighbor's trying to be scientific, and you've got two cards in your hand, one which is a super military card, but another one which is a super science card, you have to decide, okay, if I take this military card and then hand this science card to my neighbor, I'm essentially giving them 9 extra points, but I get this military card, which helps me potentially, but will it be enough? And so you really, you're sitting there really going, I wish I could do both of these, or, you know, like, so it does a very nice job of creating that kind of tension, and that sense of choice, and the choices that matter.
Yeah, and I think that what I've sort of realized is I enjoy the games like Seven Wonders, like Dominion, like Agricola the couple of times that I've played it.
Agricola stresses me out.
Yeah, but it's... I like the games that are kind of about building my thing, and there's you know, things that can be interactive. There's ways that people can block
mess
me
with
or
things.
Mess with that. But I like the not directly as competitive.
Your armies are not smashing against each
other
every
turn. There is a competition to it. There are, you know, especially in Seven Wonders, you can, you know, you have the military.
Yeah.
At the end of each stage, you have sort of the military battles. But at the end of the day, it's really about, you know, I'm playing, you know, Babylon in this, and I'm trying to build my Hanging Gardens of Babylon, and I'm trying to build up other aspects of my civilization. And it's really sort of there's interactive aspects to it.
But you're building up your own little garden.
It's not just about beating someone else. And maybe it's because games were so competitive in my family.
You're only winning if someone was definitively losing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, I think that gave me a real distaste for board games for a long time. And I think what I've enjoyed rediscovering, especially the European games, is that there is much more a game aspect to it. It's play, it's fun.
Yeah.
And I think that so many of the board games that are kind of like the classic board games are really about winning and losing.
Well, and I mean, Monopoly was literally designed to teach like the evils of certain economic models.
Yeah.
I mean, it is the worst. But anyway, I can go into that more. Now, a game that we have mentioned a few times as a game that
best game in the entire world.
My brothers acquired it kind of piecemeal in the late 80s, and eventually it wound up in Nigeria. I played it a few times in Baltimore, and then they sent it to me in Nigeria, where I promptly lost a lot of the pieces. But I still have it, and I have its new version as well, where they tried to do a bit of an 80s ectomy.
It's the most gloriously 80s game in the entire world.
I do like pulling out from time to time this old battered game that I think is in like a stationary box.
I thought it was in like an old clothes box.
It's in like, it's some like Belk's box or something like that. But this is Talisman. Talisman was developed by Games Workshop, the people who do Warhammer. and the Warhammer 40K and games like that. And it is essentially analog World of Warcraft.
Isn't it also based on British schoolboys?
It is based on British schoolboys, but that let's not give that away quite yet. In Talisman, the basic game has one board, but there's with all the expansions, I think there's about four altogether. And it's a fantasy kingdom, and it's, you know, you're a little guy. You pick a character, you draw from this massive character deck, so you can be a witch or an elf or a pirate or a swashbuckler an astronaut or a space marine, because the expansions make it ridiculous. And you play your character, and you sort of are tooling along on the board, looking, you know, drawing cards, fighting monsters, collecting treasure, running into each other, and trying to steal treasure from each other. And it is just absolutely insane. It's there's no sense of balance to it whatsoever. There's no real structure. You sort of just keep playing and like building up and getting like wealthier and wealthier and bigger and bigger.
And trying to get into the inner rings.
Yeah. So there's like three layers of the main board. There's kind of an outer region that you can move around in, and you know, you're drawing adventure cards that, you know, let you fight monsters and things like that, but for the most part it's pretty benign. And then there's a middle ring where things get a little more dangerous. You know, if you roll the dice wrong, you'll wind up in a desert and lose one of your lives, or you'll have to like fight a black knight who'll, you know, potentially kill you. And you're trying to get into this sort of final ring, which is all just like if you haven't collected enough treasure or like be leveled up, you know, the equivalent of leveling up enough, you'll just die instantly. And once you get to the very middle, you get the Crown of Command, which is not how you win, but how you can begin to win. And this was based around like British school, like you know, the British public
system.
The public school system. Like you had to like move up in years. So the idea was, you know, you were like a first year and like second year, and then like it was to become like head boy. But so this guy had devised a game based on this idea, and Games Workshop or someone said, I like this mechanic. Let's not make it about little boys in school, and instead make it about orcs. And it works very well, and it's ridiculous. And again, has like 8,000 rules.
It's the most absurd game in the world. I think at one point playing this,
yes,
I was a witch riding a unicorn,
yes,
wielding a battle axe with a princess as one of my followers in my retinue.
And I mostly remember you using that unicorn and battle axe to ride down my poor little minstrel every every chance you had.
It was great.
Because, yeah, you'll be like... They'll be like, you know, I am a mighty powerful, like, warrior of chaos, and I have 8,000 weapons. It's like, I am a bard. I have a lute.
And then we were playing another game where I ended up, I was a minotaur who ended up in the like, little city expansion.
Oh, did you become mayor?
I became mayor, or possibly sheriff of, like, the little town.
Yeah.
And then, but my alignment kept getting changed.
Yes.
Like, I kept going into somewhere that would change my... So, I would go back and forth from being
good
and
evil.
And, like, just completely randomly. And it was awesome.
It is so strange
and
weird.
And then there's the space expansion. And so, we have...
That's
like,
right. You can go to space. So, you can be a lot... And that introduces weird, like, oh, you can be a mad scientist or a space marine.
I think it's just... I think in the process of doing this podcast, I've reached a philosophical point.
Yes.
About board games and myself.
All right. Let's hear it.
That clearly I just enjoy the journey.
It's true.
And that's what Talisman is about. Whoever wins a game of Talisman, it's impossible. Like you said, if you could actually manage by some miracle to work your way into the center without being destroyed, you don't win. You just get to control the rest of the game.
Okay, so what happens, and this last time I played this game, I think to its conclusion, I warned everyone. I said, look, we should just have it that when you get to the center, you win. Please, when you get to the center, you win. And my friend's like, no, let's play it like you're supposed to play it. And I went, okay, all right. And what happens is that when you get, whoever gets to the center...
Bilbo finds it outrageous.
Yes, Bilbo does find it outrageous. Whoever gets to the center gets the Crown of Command, which means that they sit there for the rest of the game, and every turn, they turn to the players and say, do you submit? And if they submit, if everyone submits, then they win. If they don't submit, then they roll a die, and like if they roll like a 5 or 6, that person loses a life. So, essentially, the winner is a sniper and, like, a belfry who is just trying to, like, take pot shots at the other players. And the idea is, like, it gives them time to race to, like, get to the center. And that's happened before. And that's been pretty epic where you're, like, you know, where the timing works out and you're all of you, like, you know, fighting over the crown. But that's very rare. Usually one person will get there and everyone else is sort of, like, way behind. And then this guy in the, you know, the center is stuck doing nothing but sniping his fellow players who are, you know, like, screw you. And I think, like, one person had, like, a ring of restoration, so they were like getting their one life back every time. Mm-hmm. So the game could not end. But it is ridiculous and it is strange. And Fantasy Flight, I believe, tried to make a new version, which I own, which they did a very good job trying to balance the rules and to make it make more sense. But it just
lacks a little bit of the heart.
It loses out on its charm.
I think it also helps that we play it with your D&D miniatures, so yes. All of the various characters and all of the various, like, obstacles that show, you know, we have visual representation.
Yeah. No, it's really fun to use, like, minis for it because you're fighting, like, you know, you'll accidentally unleash a dragon, and then that dragon will be there for the rest of the game because no one can, like, defeat it. Before I had minis, though, what I used, because I lost several pieces, including the, like, actual pieces that represented each of the characters, I used Legos.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so I, like, little Legos all over the place. And I would literally, like, swap out the weapons as they got new weapons. Like, you have a sword now. Plop. You have an axe. Plop. Yeah. Good times. And yeah, so that's Talisman is an epic game if you can find it. I have ruined my poor 1980s copy, but it can still be played rather nicely.
I think I actually have a picture of when we were once playing Talisman and had, like, all four boards in use once. We should find it and put it on the.
I agree.
So I feel like the one game we haven't talked about that we do play quite often, which is full of its own absurdities, is Mad Scientist University.
Mad Scientist University really falls in a similar vein as your Balderdashes or your Apples to Apples. And Balderdash we didn't really mention, because Balderdash has been a game that's sort of been around for a while and you know, filled a very, you know, filled a big niche in my gaming life, because I do love Balderdash. But Mad Scientist University does a similar thing. The idea is, like an Apples to Apples or Balderdash, every round there's a judge.
It's the TA.
The TA. And he sets an insane assignment and gives everyone a sort of a wacky ingredient.
So you have to take over the world using lawn gnomes.
Yeah, like one person will have ninjas. Another person will have, like, you know, a death ray. And someone else will have paper clips.
Friend Andrew Reeves, every round descends into cannibalism. Like, his one time, the task was to find something to eat, and his object was coffee grounds, and it wasn't like, find something to eat. Well, I have coffee grounds.
Well, again, that would be too
literal.
Yes.
So it was, you have to use the coffee grounds to
befriend a barista, and lure her back into your, like, lair, where you then, like, kill and eat her. Because this man is a professor. So yes, it's you're trying to design crazy sort of a little, like, 5 minute, you write down like a few words on how you would use your item to solve the task, and you wind up with ridiculous things. Because again, it's completely uneven. Sometimes someone will have the perfect ingredient, and sometimes someone will have something completely out of left field. But it's completely subjective. So if you're the TA and you appreciate the pluck that went into the person who figured out how to use flamingos in order to fly through a black hole, then, you know, you would give the point to that person. So it's a very fun little creative game. Much like Balderdash, really depends upon you having friends with decent handwriting.
Yeah.
Many a game of Balderdash has been ruined by me trying to stumble over my friend's handwriting and being like, purple school? It's squirrel! Well, I guess we know who wrote that one then. Now, I want to touch up, we've talked about games with moving pieces, and I want to talk really briefly about some other games that I've played that you haven't played so much. And that would be Arkham Horror and Battlestar Galactica. And these are sort of games that, in theory, you're playing cooperatively. And we played Pandemic.
Oh, that was really good. I really liked that game.
And these cooperative games are very interesting because you are, in theory, sort of working together. But they require a lot of moving pieces because you essentially have to let the villains or the, you know, the dangers on the board kind of have their own turn. Mm-hmm. And that requires a whole set of weird, like, procedural algorithms that you have to work through. Arkham Horror, it's, like, completely arcane and strange, which makes sense because it's, you know, Arkham. Battlestar Galactica works out pretty well, although I think the last, like, out of the three of the four times I've played, I've accidentally put in an extra Cylon card, so humanity has been extra doomed. But when our friend brought over Pandemic, that was a lot of fun. I've been hearing a lot of great things about it. And with Pandemic, it's sort of depressing. You're sort of trying to, like, beat back the forces of infection.
And we lost.
And it's like, you're doing really well, and then, like, Lagos falls, and, you know, the rest of the world collapses. But I appreciate a game that makes extensive use of Nigeria. So, kudos for that. So that's been a little walk through our gaming history and our relationship with games and how they can sometimes cause tension in our marriage. But luckily, not too much. I'm going to post a link to my Board Game Geek profile. And Board Game Geek is a really great website. Both for looking at games and getting an idea of reviews for games and images of games, but also if you have friends who have profiles, you can see what games they have and also what their reviews of their games are. And I've gone through and given sort of little mini, like, this game's great or this game is too hard. So I'll post that up. And if you're in the Toronto area and you want to play any of them, simply drop me a line. Maybe I can convince Rachel to play.
I will play.
Probably can't convince her to play Illuminati New World Order. She is shaking her head in fear.
That's pretty much all I got.
All right.
I kind of think you should go get us some frozen yogurt, though.
I can probably attempt to do that in my sickened state.
Hey.
So next time you hear us, hopefully we will be able to report on our various cons. Hopefully Rachel will not have, like, you know, embarrassed herself too badly in front of Patrick Stewart. I think she should talk about how sexy he was in I, Claudius with his curly hair.
That man is improved with baldness.
And on that note, geek out, y'all.
One Orion, a Roaisha in Vulcan, and Klingon, it's Kata, which sort of sounds like a threat. Aijalau is Romulan, but not exactly canon, in case we make the fanboys upset.
Nikartelegar Tarasim is Mandalorian, in and out of galaxy long gone by. If you speak Hatties, you say Umajimuna.
But there is also Settlers of Canaan, which is Catan, and all the rules for Catan, only you're in the Holy Land, and it's got added, like, rules and points for building the temple in Jerusalem, which is kind of amazing.
That one definitely made an appearance at some of the seminary board game nights.
There's also a Mormon version as well.
Of course there is.